I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been compared over the years to the Vietnam War that until recently was the longest in U.S. history. In fact, going back to the 20th century, two superpowers, first France and then the United States, both got bogged down in bloody conflicts in Vietnam. Our guest, Frederick Logaval, reconstructs some of that history in his book, Embers of War. He begins his book with Ho Chi Minh in Paris after the end of World War I. He then explores the events and decisions that led to the French Indochina War, which laid the groundwork for U.S. intervention. Frederick Logaval is the John S. Knight Professor of International Studies, Professor of History at Cornell University. He also serves as Director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies. His previous book about the Vietnam War is titled Choosing War. And Frederick Logaval, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
This is a big, sprawling book. You
yes,
said
it
took
is.
10 years to write.
Indeed.
Because, and what's interesting is it's about leading up to the U.S. war. And of course, in this country, we're semi-obsessed about the U.S. war.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guilty of this myself. In my previous work, I was very much focused on the period of heavy U.S. involvement. And in the course of doing that work, I became more and more interested in exploring what happened before and more convinced that I had to understand better World War II and its transformative effects in Indochina, and then, as you mentioned, the French Indochina War. And I, even though I taught courses on the war, I hadn't really gone back and looked at this period closely.
Well, your book begins with Ho Chi Minh. It's 1919. Mm. He's in Paris.
Yeah.
Why is he in Paris?
He's in Paris. Oh, well, for several reasons. He had left Vietnam in 1911. Hounded really by French intelligence agents who knew that he was an emerging nationalist leader. He felt, I better get out of here. And so then he spent several years traveling around. He, in fact, spent some time in the United States. He was a pastry chef in London. But he settled then in Paris after World War I. But the reason I begin is because what he wanted to do, the reason I begin in 1919 in Paris is he felt that if he could get an audience with Woodrow Wilson.
President Woodrow Wilson.
And make the case for Vietnamese independence and make the case why Wilson's message of self-determination for all people should also apply to him, to the Vietnamese, then maybe he would get American support. So he rented a tuxedo, you know, tried to look his best, tried to get an audience with Wilson. He failed. He didn't see Wilson or any of the other Allied leaders. But it's the first, I think, of many attempts by Ho to get American support for his cause.
Well, even when he talks about the Declaration of Independence, yeah, essentially for Vietnam,
oh, yeah,
he quotes our own Declaration,
oh,
of,
yeah,
Independence word for word about,
yeah,
people being men being created equal.
Oh, yeah.
Like liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
This is an extraordinary moment in 1945 after the Japanese have been defeated. And his organization, the Viet Minh, comes in, declares Vietnamese independence, as you say, proclaims what they call the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and Ho borrows from the American Declaration. And it's a naked play for American support. I think he also believes the words, but he thinks, I've worked with the OSS here at the end of the Pacific War. I get along with OSS officers. They seem to be saying to me that we will support you. Here's my chance.
Well, in fact, talking about the OSS, I guess this was during World War II in,
yes,
Vietnam. They actually made him an honorary member of the OSS, Agent 19, they called him.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a fascinating part of this story that they had these interactions in Tonkin, which is the northern part of Vietnam under the French, in opposing the Japanese toward the end of the war, to some extent at least indirectly also opposing a French return. And OSS officers said time and again, Ho is somebody somebody we can work with. And he, as I said, came to believe the same thing. He thought, the Americans will be on my side. The United States, after all, was founded as in an anti-colonial reaction to Britain. Why would they not back me in this quest for independence for my people?
A provocative question and a complicated answer.
Yeah.
In part, it's what your book is about. I guess it's also about the rise of communism after World War II.
Oh, yeah.
Did that complicate this relationship?
Oh, no question. And I should make clear that Ho Chi Minh, by the time we get into the 1940s, and that indeed well before then, I believe he was a dedicated communist. He believed that Marxism-Leninism represented the best path of development for his country, but it was always his country. And so when scholars debate, was Ho a nationalist or was he a communist, I don't think he saw that distinction in his own mind. I think he thought it was possible to be both. And I argue in the book that nationalism in his mind, it seems to me, always came first. But it did complicate the issue for Americans, no questions, that he was a communist.
But do you think he wanted a true alliance with the United States? Was that part of his vision?
Well, I think it's an interesting what if. Suppose the United States had opted to support his cause, what would have happened? I don't think he would have been an ally in the formal sense with the United States. But I think it is possible to see him taking a kind of middle path between working with the Soviet Union and working with the United States. He might have been a Tito-like figure, that is the Yugoslav leader, mm-hmm. who was a communist but independent really in some ways of Soviet control.
Your book begins with Ho Chi Minh in Paris, and Vietnam, I guess, was part of the French Empire.
Correct.
Going back to what, the 19th century?
About the middle part of the 19th century is when the French begin to arrive in a serious way. By the mid-1880s, they had established firm control. They saw this as a crown jewel in the French Empire, and they saw this as a place where they really needed to be very well established. And then over the course of the next 2-3 decades, they begin to deal with this emerging Vietnamese nationalist movement. They don't know quite how to handle it, and this is where Ho emerges as really the leader in this movement.
And it leads to this almost 10-year war.
Yes.
A very bloody conflict.
Yeah. The French Indochina War really begins in earnest in late 1946. There is skirmishing, there's fighting already in late 45. And the nature of that war is, I think, absolutely critical to understanding why the Americans then become involved themselves. Because as the war progresses, as that French Indochina War progresses, the United States becomes steadily more involved in backing the French cause. And then once the French are defeated, they make that fateful decision to basically try to succeed where the French had failed.
You write about General, is it Giap or Giap?
Zap.
Zap.
Yeah.
And he was a military leader. And you also quote in here a description of guerrilla warfare, just a couple of quotes. The miracle of the guerrilla is that the whole population contributes. The soldier is the inhabitant, and the inhabitant is the soldier. Going on to describe the kind of thinking and strategy that became part of this guerrilla warfare.
Yeah, and I think it was key to ultimate Viet Minh success, that the kind of description that you've just given is what Zapp and his subordinate commanders were able to count on. They had very broad popular support, not to say that it was total. There were always, as I also show, there were always people who were opposed to the Viet Minh, who were opposed to the communism that was at the heart of the party and of the movement. And the Viet Minh could be very ruthless with domestic opponents. But the fact remains, and this was intensely frustrating both to the French and then later to the Americans, that when French troops, for example, would enter a village, they could never know who was on their side and who wasn't. The locals would tell Viet Minh units about French movements and how many troops were in this French unit, what kind of weapons they had. But when the French asked the villagers these questions, they clammed up.
Right.
And so it is very much a popular war in that respect.
And the Viet Minh is the name for the military fighting the French.
If we think of this as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, that is the proclaimed government led by Ho Chi Minh, we can think of the Viet Minh as, in a sense, I suppose we could say that the military arm of that government, though I can also use them synonymously in terms of the government and the military forces.
Talking about some of the brutality, I guess, associated with Ho Chi Minh and his vision. I mean, we're talking about what, labor camps and land reforms.
Oh, yeah, and assassination of village elders. I mean, the Viet Minh used assassination, used terror a lot, and we should be mindful of that. They were good, it seems to me, maybe in quotes, mm-hmm. at using it selectively. That is to say, you target that particular village elder who is already hated. Maybe he's a big landowner. Maybe he's a very nasty fellow. You target him, and very often you then get people to support the Viet Minh mm-hmm. going forward. And it's also a warning, obviously, to other village elders. You better back us, or the same thing could happen to you. So there's definitely that part of what the Viet Minh are doing throughout this period, throughout the period of the French War, and indeed afterward.
And when you say terror, is it terror the way we think of it today?
Well, it's partly terror the way we think of it today. It's different in the sense that these are in many cases Viet Minh authorities who are doing this to certain members of the population. It's also often more targeted in the sense that it will be a grenade placed in a particular spot. It'll be killing somebody with a knife in the depth of night. So perhaps not the sort of thing we think of after 9/11 in terms of broad use against civilians.
Did the French have any idea what they were up against? I mean, perhaps in hindsight, but as they were fighting this protracted war?
I think you make a very important distinction there between hindsight and what was known at the time. To a degree that I found surprising in my research, they did know what they were up against.
They did.
I think the French were realists. Both civilians in Paris and the commanders on the ground in Indochina, I think, understood from an early point that they were up against a very, very ferocious movement against a powerful nationalist force led by Ho Chi Minh. But here's what's interesting. They understood this, but they could never make the mental leap required to make concessions that would have a hope of mollifying this force. So they saw, boy, we face a very difficult foe here. But the idea of giving the Vietnamese more autonomy, even giving them, pledging ultimate independence to them, that was something that was outside their imaginations, and they could never quite bring themselves to do that.
And we're almost up in a break here. Is that because they were a colonial power and that's how they thought about their empire?
I think it was that they felt that we could have what we had before. Prior to World War II, a few thousand French soldiers could maintain control over 25 million Indochinese. Indochina brought resources to the metropolitan France, brought lots of things, and they hoped that they could get that again.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Frédéric Longueval, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his book. It's called Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling depressed, anxious? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of depression or anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moscoane, and I'm here to remind you about the important role that you play at WHYY. We get about half of our operating funds from people like you who listen. That's why we say listener supported. We're in what we hope is the final stretch of the winter membership campaign, and we want you to make a pledge of support right now. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. We need to stay on track and make our hourly goals. This morning on Radio Times, the history that led to the Vietnam War with author Frédéric Longueval and filmmaker Byron Hurt talking about his documentary, Soul Food Junkies. We cover everything on Radio Times. What's that worth to you? How about a pledge of $60 and we'll send you the Radio Times anniversary mug designed by our very own Pulitzer Prize winning Tony Auth. 1-888-345-9499. And you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for making that pledge. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Frederick Logaval about how and why two powerful nations, first France and then the United States, got bogged down in Vietnam. And that's the subject of his book called Embers of War. He's also the author of a previous book about the Vietnam War called Choosing War. And it's our topic today on Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY, talking about the Indochina War, and you call it something else in this book.
Well, it has
several names.
It has several names.
Depending which side you're on, I guess.
I usually say French Indochina War, but it's also known as the Franco-Viet Minh War. Some Vietnamese call it the First War of Liberation. It has lots of names.
But the showdown, I guess, happens at Dien Bien Phu.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's the one of the great military encounters of modern times. And it's something that I felt I had to deal with in the book because it did mark, at least symbolically, the end of the French Empire in this part of the world. Both sides attached great importance to the battle because both knew that negotiations were coming, and the Viet Minh under General Giap thought we need to have a clear victory at Dien Bien Phu in order to maximize our position before those negotiations. And the French thought, if we can decimate the Viet Minh in this remote valley in northern Vietnam, then we're in a better position come those negotiations.
Well, you include a photo in here, and I circled it. It's hard to describe, but your description is a parade of specially modified bicycles, many of them French-made Peugeots, loaded with food and munitions on a road to Dien Bien Phu in January 1954. And here are, it looks like, about maybe 20 bicycles and bicyclists loaded up with what looks like kale or, you know, some kind of cabbage. And then apparently, lots of munitions, a bicycle going up a hill to provide provisions.
Well, the degree to which the Viet Minh were able to use and skillfully use every means that they had at their disposal, including these specially fitted bicycles, is just extraordinary. And there are also images of porters and troops, coolies as they used to be called, pushing artillery pieces up steep hillsides in the mud to get them in place on the hillsides overlooking Dien Bien Phu, which of course proved to be crucial to the French defeat. But the bicycles are a really interesting part of the story.
But does it also tell us about just how much the Vietnamese hated the French and how determined they were to defeat them in war?
Oh, I think it does. There's no question that what we see here is this almost indescribable determination on their part. I do think it's worth saying two things. One is that the Chinese assistance that the Viet Minh received starting in 1950, but especially here in the climax of the struggle, that Chinese aid was very important. And bear in mind that Dien Bien Phu is close to the Chinese border. So lots of material flowed in those critical months. The other thing we're saying is that the Viet Minh were exhausted by the time the battle was over, I think to a degree that we haven't realized. They had their own morale problems and their own concerns about whether they would be able to sustain this for much longer.
Because it was just such a horrific, bloody battle.
Yes, and they lost huge numbers. In terms of their casualty rates at Dien Bien Phu, they're really quite extraordinary.
Let me get, it looks like Robert from Skipack to join our conversation. And Robert, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm just interested in the Chinese involvement in the history of North Vietnam. You just mentioned it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I understand that Ho Chi Minh went to China for a while and studied communism there, and then they helped them in a great extent, technology, during the war itself. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Sure, Robert. Thanks for the call. Yes,
well, it's a very good question. And yes, Ho Chi Minh had spent time in China. He had spent time in the Soviet Union. He initially was very involved with the French Socialist and French Communist parties. But he spent time in China beginning in 1950. After Mao's victory in the Chinese Civil War, the Chinese assistance to the Viet Minh becomes steadily more important. And bear in mind that we've got the border Right across the frontier from North Vietnam is, of course, or from the northern part of Vietnam, from Tonkin, is China. So it's very easy for Chinese materials to flow through, especially when the French lose control of some border posts in northern Tonkin. But we should be mindful of the fact that U.S. aid to the French was always larger than Chinese aid to the Viet Minh in terms of the amount of material and in terms of the money spent. So, yes, Chinese aid is critical, but so is American aid to the French.
In fact, you raise a question in your book about whether the U.S. actually offered the French nuclear weapons near the end of the siege at Dien Bien Phu.
Oh, it's really provocative, interesting.
And of course we had used nuclear weapons a couple of years earlier.
Well, we had used it at the end of World War II, and I really wanted to get to the bottom of this because, of course, we've had various authors who have talked about this. Understandably enough, I never could find definitive evidence. I think it's very plausible, and this is what I say in the book, that John Foster Dulles told Georges Bidault at a critical moment, how about if we give you two or maybe three tactical weapons that you could use in the valley against the Viet Minh? The French said thanks, but no thanks. Because after all,
do we know that?
I think we know that. And the reason was simple. If we use these tactical nuclear weapons to kill Viet Minh divisions and units, we're also going to kill Frenchmen. Mm-hmm. And French Union forces as well in the garrison. Everybody will be dead. So I don't think it went very far. The very fact that it was mentioned is interesting. And it's plausible in the sense that U.S. officials we know talked about how nuclear weapons could be used, not just in Indochina, but elsewhere. So in 1954, this is part of a general U.S. strategic discussion.
You have another picture, and I guess this is at the very end of this battle, and it looks like the Vietnamese have arranged loudspeakers, basically say, lay down your arms, you know, we're not going to hurt you, we have won, this battle is over.
Yeah, and I think by that point, now we're talking late April, early May 1954, I think the men in the garrison are sensing the end. That is the French Union troops, which includes legionnaires, many of them German. It includes colonial troops from North Africa. It includes French men and some French women, including some prostitutes that had been flown in. I think they understood when they heard the loudspeakers, this thing is almost over. They do hold out hope that maybe the Americans will come in with massive use of air power and somehow this will change everything. But I think those loudspeakers are telling them it's close.
How do you get prostitutes into the middle of a war or a battle?
Well, many of them had been there before. In fact, perhaps all of them had been there while the airstrip was still usable. In other words, they had been flown in. And what the Viet Minh did early in the battle for Dien Bien Phu is they rendered the airstrip unusable through their bombardment. Mm-hmm. And so after that, only parachuted soldiers and parachuted supplies could come into the valley. To my knowledge, I don't think we had parachuted prostitutes.
I just wanted to make sure. So they were sort of stuck there, having been flown in before.
They had been flown in before.
And that's Frederick Logoval, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his most recent book called Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire. And that empire is the French Empire and the making of America's Vietnam. He's the John S. Knight Professor of International Studies, also Professor of History at Cornell University, serves as director, I better say this correctly, serves as director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies. I got it. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Jim from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. And Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question comes from essentially in 1972, I went away to college and I was draft age. And so I became interested in the question that your book addresses. So I just started reading with David Halberstam's Best and the Brightest. And by the time I got done, I was reading Karl Marx. So I kind of worked my way backwards on this. Here's the question. After getting through all that, I sort of came to the conclusion that Ho Chi Minh probably had more in common with George Washington than he did with, you know, Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. Mm. And I don't know whether you'd even want to make the comparison, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Jim, thanks.
Let me take this off the air.
Thanks a lot, Jim, for calling in. Yes, go ahead, Frederick.
It's an interesting question. I think that there is that in many ways he did have a lot in common with America's founders, including George Washington. And in fact, he sometimes compared himself to Washington. Mm-hmm. He said, if what I'm seeking to do for my country is similar to what you Americans did when you were battling the British, then surely I can be compared to your first president. And I guess it's even fair to say that on some level, maybe he modeled himself a little bit on George Washington. I think he had a pretty good grasp of that kind of American history. And Stalin, interestingly enough, since you mentioned Stalin, Stalin always mistrusted Ho Chi Minh. Stalin thought that Ho was way too independent-minded to be trusted. Stalin had his eyes focused on European concerns anyway, so he didn't care very much about Indochina. That being said, I wouldn't want to draw the comparison too close. As I said earlier, Ho, I think, was a dedicated communist. I think he did see the Soviet Union and then communist China under Mao as his principal partners in all of this. But the tragic part of the story is that for a long time, maybe until the late 1940s, that is well into the war against France, for a long time, Ho Chi Minh believed the Americans will be my partners in my struggle for independence. Mm. I can count on the Americans. Maybe he was naive to believe it for so long, but he did.
Would it be fair to say he was both, that he was a nationalist that might have fashioned himself on George Washington, and he was a communist as well? We often live in this either-or world.
Well, I think you make an excellent point, and I think that's precisely how I would put it. And he had... You know, Jack Langeth, a good friend of mine, has said in writing that he has referred to Ho's lifelong admiration for Americans and for the United States. Mm. And I think I show in the book some evidence of this. So he had that, and in particular this philosophical and this political connection that he felt, given how the United States had been founded, but, again, looked to the Soviet Union as the mother socialist entity and the one that he, on some level, would model his own government after.
And we're talking about someone who lived, as you said, the book begins where he's trying to appeal to yeah. President Wilson. We're also talking about FDR, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, and obviously different presidents, different times. Yeah. You know, the end of World War I, the end of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, and you've got these various presidents who are, you know, appealing to various constituencies in this country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that ultimately we're going to see from FDR all the way through to Gerald Ford, we're going to have presidents who in one way or another have to deal with Indochina, with mm-hmm. Vietnam, this place that is, you know, 7,000 miles from California. It's 10,000 miles from Philadelphia. This place that a lot of Americans have never heard of is going to become steadily more important to Americans. And ultimately, of course, in the mid-1960s, under Johnson, we're going to send lots and lots of troops to this country. 58,000 of them, more than 58,000 of them will die. But it's something that presidents are dealing with through generations.
In the preface to your book, you begin with Kennedy. It's early 1950s. He goes to Vietnam and he says, we are more and more becoming colonialists in the minds of the people because everyone believes that we can control the UN. Basically saying, you know, let's be reluctant about some of these international engagements.
Kennedy really interests me in this story. And he's a real – I think he's a tragic figure in the sense that he goes there in 51, which, as you say, is where I open the book. He arrives in Saigon with his brother Bobby, with Patricia, and he's thinking about a run for the Senate the next year. So he needs foreign policy credentials. But even then in 51, this is the middle of the French War – he asks, it seems to me, all the right questions, raises all the appropriate concerns about what Western military power can do in this part of the world. And he fears that the United States, as you say, is becoming identified with colonialism.
Yeah.
And this is a struggle we can't win. So he sees this in 51, but then, as we know, in 61, when he's president, he is – helping to build up U.S. forces. It's on his watch that a major expansion of U.S. involvement takes place, even though, I argue, toward the end of the book, he still privately has these doubts.
Is he responding to political pressures in this country? Is he worried about looking, you know, soft on communism, for instance? Or even I'm old enough to remember talk about the domino theory, that Vietnam falls, so is going to fall that rest of the world to communism.
Yeah, I don't think he personally really adhered to the domino theory privately. I think he was too much of a skeptic on those things and in a way was too sophisticated a foreign policy thinker to actually believe in a kind of mechanistic domino theory, one country falls and the others fall. But your first point is, it seems to me, spot on. I think that understanding Kennedy's Vietnam policies and then Johnson's and Nixon's, for that matter, requires paying really close attention to the domestic political imperatives that they saw. And Democrats in particular, as you know, felt a certain vulnerability to being soft on communism. McCarthyism still hung in the air, even if McCarthy himself was long gone from the scene. And I think it helps. There's no question that it explains a lot about why Kennedy and Johnson took those fateful steps in the early and middle 60s.
In fact, and I'm quoting you from your own book, for more than a dozen years, the U.S. had committed herself to preserving a non-communist toehold in Vietnam, and both men, we're talking about Johnson and Kennedy here, feared that to alter course, even under the cover of a fig leaf negotiated settlement, could be harmful in terms of credibility of their countries, their parties, and their own.
Yeah.
An issue of credibility. And you say they weren't willing to risk it. A kind of cowardice on their part?
Yeah, they were certainly not profiles in courage, to use a title of Kennedy's book.
Yeah.
But there was also in the short term, which is what politicians are most concerned about. There was a logic to what they were doing, because again, in domestic political terms, it was easier to continue on, even to deepen that involvement and to hope that it turned out well. But there's no question that this was a concern of theirs. And by the way, I would say interesting parallel here between the French and the Americans, because I do think French leaders as well became more and more focused on not the geopolitical issues in Indochina, not why it mattered to France as a nation, but why it mattered to them personally, why it mattered to their careers. I think careerism, I'm sad to say it, but careerism, both for French officials and American officials later, matters a lot in this story.
Because, and we're almost up in a break here, the idea of again, losing a war or leaving a country having not defeated.
Yes, if you have said time and again publicly, we will persevere, this is crucial to our security, to go back on that after you've said it publicly is very difficult, especially when Frenchmen have died and then Americans have died. Because what you're basically saying is we have allowed these young men and women to die for a purpose, for a cause in which we no longer believe. That's very difficult for leaders or indeed for probably human beings to deal with.
Well, let's pick up on that point after this very short break. Frederick Logaval, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Vietnam, the French involvement in Vietnam, and of course the U.S. involvement as well. His book is called Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam. And again, he's a professor at Cornell University, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Inishnua Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting Scottish playwright D.C. Jackson's My Romantic History, directed by Tom Ring, now through February 24th at the Off Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for listening to Radio Times. Now, take that next step and become a member. We get about half of our funds from our listeners, but unfortunately, only about 10% of our listeners are members. We can fix that when you take that next step and become a member. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. And you can always pledge online at WHYY.org. Think about what you get every day. 2 hours of Radio Times, Morning Edition, Talk of the Nation, Fresh Air, Newsworks, the BBC. It's a long list of local and national and international programs. Our job is to keep you informed and entertained. Your job is to support what you listen to. Today on Radio Times, the roots of the Vietnam War and a cultural, culinary, and personal history of soul food. What's that worth to you? $5, $10, $20 a month? 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. And if you're just joining us, Frederick Logeval is our guest today on Radio Times. His book is called Embers of War, a look at the French involvement in the Vietnam War. A previous book he wrote more about the U.S. involvement is called Choosing War, and he's the John S. Knight Professor of International Studies, also Professor of History at Cornell University. We have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I keep quoting you, but I figured you don't mind if I'm quoting again from your book. But in terms of, I guess, the lessons not learned of as we go from the French War in Vietnam to the American War in Vietnam, the idea that Americans describing the French, they had fought badly in Indochina and deserved to lose. Americans, on the other hand, were the good guys, militarily invincible, who selflessly had come to the help of the Vietnamese in their hour of need and then would go home. That we really, it's a country we didn't understand, and perhaps thinking that we could do better than the French.
Oh, no question. There was a feeling that the French, a broad feeling, that the French War really didn't offer that many lessons for Americans, because the French were a decadent people. They were colonialists. They were trying vainly to prop up this empire. That's not what we're about. And moreover, as you say, we're militarily invincible. They had been smoked in 1940 easily by the Germans. We saw what the French were capable of. And I think that thinking persisted for a long time. Over time, interestingly, as the Americans themselves became bogged down in Indochina, they said, well, wait a minute now, maybe the French experience does have something to teach us. And so that view dissipated with time by at least the more thoughtful and the more honest U.S. officials. But no question, early on there was this belief that we can basically ignore what the French experienced because we won't have that problem. Moreover, the Vietnamese now will have something to fight for. Now they'll be fighting for their independence, for their freedom, with American support.
You mentioned Dulles, but I'd like to ask you about Eisenhower, because it looks like he was perhaps ambivalent, divided over what U.S. policy in Vietnam should be.
I think he was. I do argue in the book that he was more, to use the later American terminology, he was more of a hawk on Indochina than some of his supporters have suggested. I think he was serious in the spring of 1954 of intervening militarily to try to bail out the French. That said, he was also an experienced military man, and he saw that Vietnam was going to be difficult terrain. He saw that you were up against, in the Viet Minh, a very determined foe. So I think he was ambivalent. But in strategic terms, he actually believed that Indochina was more important than Korea, and he said this frequently. He said, if we lose Indochina, that will have more important strategic implications than Korea. And this was the kind of domino theory thinking that he was sometimes prone to having.
And at what point were there about 1,000 U.S. advisors in Vietnam?
Well, by the time we get into 55 and 56, they're coming in very quickly, even in the latter part of the French War. You're seeing more and more Americans. In fact, one of the powerful things in Graham Greene's classic novel, The Quiet American, is how he opens the book by suggesting the Americans are now an ever more present presence here in Indochina. So even in the latter part of the French, they're coming in more and more, but it's especially after the French defeat and after you get into having a South Vietnamese government in 1954 that the U.S. begins to send more and more of these advisors.
And they're advising the South Vietnamese government?
They are advising the government on many different levels. They're helping to to set up the South Vietnamese infrastructure. They are also advising the South Vietnamese military in very important ways. And then, as I suggested earlier, it's under Kennedy that we see a rapid increase in the number of advisors, and then, of course, ground troops, large numbers under Johnson.
About Diem, who you describe in the beginning of the book as an intelligent and curious, intelligent and courageous patriot, but then by the end of the book, who became a royal oligarch.
Yeah. Well, he's the leader of South Vietnam. So he's the U.S.-supported leader after the French have left. The country's been divided, supposedly temporarily. He takes control in the South. That's where the U.S. is going to have this non-communist bastion. And I think we have to take Diem seriously. And this is one of the things that I learned in the course of researching this book, that he was, as you say, a courageous patriot.
Well, you said, yes.
And he was somebody with his own vision for his country's future. I also think that he had severe defects as a leader. I think it's hard to imagine the Diem experiment surviving long term, so I wouldn't want to go too far down that road. But we have to think about what he sought to do and what he represented in a serious way.
And what were his deficits?
Well, I think he was myopic. I think he was somebody who did not understand the need to build popular support for his own policies, if you can imagine. And he had a tendency to delegate only to a small circle of advisors, many of them family members. Politically quite tone deaf, I think it's fair to say.
But kind of wined and dined by the U.S.
Right? Oh, boy, yeah. And he had this visit near the end of the book. I talk about his visit to Washington and to the New York ticker tape parade on Broadway and a speech to Congress. He comes in 57, and he is depicted as the great savior of Vietnam. He is the man who is going to be the miracle man, as they put it. And even John Kennedy, who, as I suggested earlier, was skeptical. Even Kennedy got caught up in this fervor to some degree, and people believed that with Diem we will actually prevail in Vietnam, and finally the revolution will be defeated, and we'll have this pro-U.S. government in Saigon.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have George from Freehold, New Jersey. And George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was there early in 66, and you are right about so much that you said. This is my question. Do you think that the fact that we were ambivalent set in motion a pattern that caused us to continuously enter into small wars and always lose in these small wars?
That's a very interesting and provocative question, George. I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Well, if you mean that the very ambivalence was the reason for us to get involved in the first place, I'm not sure. I haven't quite thought about it precisely in those terms. I do think it's fair to say that one of the remarkable themes, and I think this is clear in the archival record, is that in Indochina there were voices from the very beginning that were ambivalent. And the leading example in World War II is Franklin Roosevelt, who certainly believed that we have no business propping up a colonialist enterprise in Indochina. And all the way through you see this ambivalence, not least then in Kennedy and Johnson. I mean, it's just amazing to hear the Johnson tapes and to hear Lyndon Johnson, even as he's Americanizing the war, saying, what the hell is Vietnam worth to me? What is it worth to this country? So Johnson wondered about this. Johnson had ambivalence. I guess I would put it this way, which is slightly different than your question suggested, is that notwithstanding that ambivalence, notwithstanding their realistic sense of, in many ways, of the obstacles ahead, they were not as ignorant about the problems as is sometimes suggested. They nevertheless took the plunge, both in this case and in other cases that we could think of in post-war history.
Is that hubris? Thank you, George,
for
the call, by the way.
I think it is hubris, although not in the way that David Halberstam suggested in his classic work, which a previous caller referred to. And The Best and the Brightest is a monumental work. But I think that, Halberstam gets it slightly wrong, in that I think there was hubris. There was hubris about America's right to be in Vietnam. In other words, Americans felt, yes, we can tell the Vietnamese what to do. Yes, we know what's best. So there's that hubris, exaggerated self-confidence. There wasn't hubris, I think, in terms of how easy it would be. That is to say, as I indicated a while ago, I think from an early point, McNamara, Bundy, Kennedy, Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, many other U.S. elites saw the problems that they were facing. So I think Halberstam maybe exaggerates the hubris to some extent, but it's there in terms of we know what's best for the Vietnamese, and we can tell them what to do.
But it's even more troublesome to think that there were people who are making policy and running this war that had such, if not ambivalence, doubts about what we were doing, but doing it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's...
And sending people into a war they weren't sure... I mean, this is what McNamara talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't sure we could actually win.
Yes, and I think it's a very troubling part of both the French and the American wars, and it's something that ties them together. I think that French officials by 49 and 50, which is well before the end of the war, French officials had these deep doubts. And yet they keep sending Frenchmen, legionnaires, colonial troops, Indochinese troops to fight and die for a cause they no longer really believe is essential to French security. That's deeply troubling. By the same token, I think we know now that Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, all of them had these doubts about whether Vietnam was really worth it, whether it mattered so much to American security, and yet they do this. And that's extremely troubling.
Let me get, that looks like J.C. from, is that Cookwood, Delaware? J.C., go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I read maybe in Bernard Fall's book that one of the reasons that the French went into Ben Phu was to maintain the control of the poppy for the heroin trade going into Marseille. Can you comment on that?
J.C., thanks for the call. You write about Bernard Fall in your book.
Yeah, Bernard Fall is obviously really important to this story and an important and fascinating figure. And I actually close the book with Bernard Fall, and he enters into the narrative earlier. He and others have suggested that one of the motivations for the French in deciding to make a stand at Dien Bien Phu, which again is in this remote part of northern Vietnam, close to the Laotian border, is because of a desire to control the opium harvest. And I think there is something to this. I wouldn't put it at the top of the causal hierarchy. I think there were other reasons that were more important in leading them to make a stand there. They wanted to block a Viet Minh invasion of Laos. They wanted to have a set-piece battle in a remote area where they thought they could decimate Viet Minh units. But I think that opium mattered. Opium was lucrative to the French. It was also lucrative to the Viet Minh because the Viet Minh used the proceeds, if you will, the profits, to purchase weapons and ammunition that they would then use against the French. So I think it was one motivation, no question.
J.C., thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I'm Artie Moskowen. You're listening to Radio Times, and our guest is Frederick Loggeval, author of Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire, and The Making of America's Vietnam. Again, Radio Times here on WHYY. You can't read a book like this and not think about the wars in Iraq and particularly Afghanistan, because as we know, the Soviets, you know, couldn't essentially win in Afghanistan. And here we are now the longest war of U.S. history, replacing Vietnam. Do you see parallels to our involvement especially in Afghanistan?
I think there are parallels between the Vietnam experience and these two later wars. There are also very important differences. Analogizing is always a chancy proposition. But there are interesting similarities about, I think, what has motivated the U.S. involvement, if I can put it that way. And I keep coming back to this, to the theme that politics is critical. And I guess I would say, to draw the comparison in particular with Afghanistan, since you emphasized that one, is that it seems to me that in South Vietnam, in, say, the mid and late 60s, and in Afghanistan today with Karzai, the U.S. is supporting a government that lacks broad-based popular support, that maintains at best a tenuous hold on the population. There are real problems in both instances in terms of the security. And so the U.S. is in both instances backing a government that doesn't have the kind of control that it needs to have. So that's one way in which politics matters. I think politics also matters in the domestic U.S. case. And I've already indicated that I think it's key to understanding how we got involved and then escalated in Vietnam, the perceived domestic imperatives involved. And I think also for U.S. policymakers today, I think that Barack Obama presumably had several reasons for escalating U.S. involvement in Afghanistan in 2009. You'll remember there was a strategic review. He then opted to expand U.S. involvement. But I don't doubt, I think it would be naive to believe that he didn't do so, at least in part, because he thought that an escalation with a particular end date would play to his right flank, because he would show his commitment to prevailing in Afghanistan. But by setting a strict timetable, he would also mollify voices in the Democratic Party who didn't want an endless war. So I think that the political strategizing is another connection between these two wars.
And we're almost out of time here, but I'm also thinking about an involvement in a country or in a war that we really don't understand. I mean, you know, these complicated cultures with deep history.
I think it's really true. Though, again, as I suggested earlier, we sometimes exaggerate the extent of our ignorance. I think in the Vietnam case, we now have ample evidence. You mentioned McNamara earlier. McNamara, in his memoir and in other publications, would say, if only we had known. Well, in fact, McNamara did know. I think he knew the obstacles. And by the same token, my guess is that there is a lot of realism now about Afghanistan on the part of U.S. officials.
Well, Frederick Loegewald, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
The book is called Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.